Tonight we have a very special, for me anyway, a very special member. I've known Conrad now for many years. So we've got Conrad Schakowsky, who has come along tonight to give his first talk here at the Buddhist Society. So I trust you'll all give him a warm reception and a warm welcome. Conrad has been a member, as I say, here for many years, but he's been away for 2 or 3 years. He's been over living in Melbourne. His family still lives here, of course, but he's just brought his family back, happily for us, to Perth, and hopefully he'll be staying here and sort of joining the many activities that we do here at the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Conrad is in his normal day life. I mean, when I first knew Conrad, he was a planning officer, a planning man down at the Fremantle Council. And I know from there he's gone and worked for the harbour. That's the right way to say it, the harbour, Fremantle Harbour Port, or the Port Authority. And now he's rejigged himself again now to present himself as a social worker. And I know that he's doing this job very, very successfully. Been doing that over in Melbourne. I'm sure he'll call on lots of that experience that he's had there in tonight's talk. So without further ado, I'll now hand you over to Conrad, who will do tonight's talk and meditation. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Dennis. It's a lovely and generous introduction. And yes, my name's Conrad. First time speaking here tonight, but you know, a member for many years now. And the topic I wanted to bring tonight was spiritual conversation. And I guess the background to the topic is from my work as a social worker, like Dennis just mentioned. But working in a forensic psychiatric hospital in Melbourne, it's called Thomas Embling Hospital, and it was there that the chaplain and I co-facilitated a group called the Spiritual Conversation Group, and the format of the group was that each session would draw off a theme, a spiritual theme, through a either a Buddhist story or a Christian story, and in doing so, we found that you know the theme, particularly between us, you know, the Christian chaplain and me as a Buddhist social worker, the theme was very relatable, whether it was from the Buddhist tradition or the Christian tradition, but also to our clients. You know, some of the clients might have identified with a religion, others not. But, you know, had an openness to spirituality and you know, different ways of making sense of life. And it was really interesting how we all were able to relate around this, the topics that were brought for discussion to the group. How's that? Yeah. I guess, you know, the clients that we're working with there were, and a lot of the clients were there on mental impairment orders. So, you know, that offended, usually, you know, pretty serious crimes. And when they went to court, the courts, you know, found them not guilty by reason of mental impairment for their offence. You know, they didn't know what they were doing at the time because they were so unwell, or didn't know it was wrong because they were so unwell. Or the other cohort of clients we worked with there were people in prison who became really unwell in prison that needed to come for acute mental health treatment before returning to prison. And it was just it was beautiful to see, you know, simple topics shared in this group, and you know, probably 98% of the people there able to relate to them. And I guess the intention of the group wasn't necessarily to add anything new to the person's story when they came in, but a task of noticing. So noticing how the theme was already at play in your life, and then having a chance to share and be heard around that theme. And some of the themes that we looked at were, you know, imperfection, compassion, service, letting go. And there's a couple of little stories I'll draw on tonight that we talked about in the group. And I'll share the story and just share a bit about how I made sense of it in tonight's talk. So that's, you know, the one origin of the topic of spiritual conversation. But the other side is I just think it's a very important part of Buddhist practice, and it makes me think of the sutta with Ananda and the Buddha, where Ananda goes to the Buddha and says, "Oh, Buddha, I think that the spiritual life must be, you know, 50% of the." Sorry, he says, "I think that spiritual friendship must be, you know, 50% of the spiritual life." And the Buddha says, "No, no, Ananda, it's all the spiritual life." And just knowing how important, you know, it is to be in contact with each other, practicing the way we do here, because, you know, it's not easy to keep precepts and to meditate regularly and to live generously. They're kind of, it depends on seeing that and having that message modeled and transmitted by someone else who understands it. So I think that's another sort of motive for the topic tonight, a spiritual conversation. I'll talk about one of the stories that we used in the group. And if you've been coming here for a while, or you know Ajahn Brahm, I'm sure you know the story, the two bad bricks. So it's a good, simple story that we used there in the group. And I'll relay the story again. I'm sure you know, many of you have heard it. The story is about Ajahn Brahm when he's building Bodhinyana Monastery. And he's in the very poor monks at the time and have to do the construction work themselves. So Ajahn builds his first brick wall in the monastery and stands back to admire the wall, but sees that there's these two misshapen, sort of poorly laid bricks in the wall. And that's the focus that Ajahn has on the wall. He can just see that the two bad bricks in the wall, and can't stand the wall because of this. And one day he's walking around the monastery with a friend, and the friend stops and says, "Oh, look, you know, what a beautiful wall." And Ajahn says, "You know, can't you see those two bad bricks? It's a terrible wall." And the friend says, well, I can see those two bad bricks, but I can also see the 998 good bricks. And it's from that point, Ajahn says he could too see the 998 good bricks in the wall. He could see the bigger picture after that person shared their experience of the wall with him. And the other person didn't deny the bad bricks in the wall for Ajahn, but it didn't bother his friend. He was able to see the 998 good bricks, and so too was Ajahn Brahm afterwards. So it's a really good story, and the way we talked about it in the group was around, you know, spiritual conversation, spiritual friendship, you know, and how important it is sometimes to have someone there who can help us see the bigger picture, help us see beyond the two bad bricks, the two things that might disturb us, or we might find difficult. And you know, it's kind of a proud story and a fun one too. That there was a patient in the hospital, and he was there for maybe 20 years, and kind of a pretty challenging guy. He'd assaulted staff, and he'd assaulted, you know, many patients over the years. You know, he trafficked drugs in the hospital. Got up to all sorts of stuff, and it wasn't the most likable kind of guy. But he came to our groups, and, you know, he had a space in our group to share his experience and be heard. And this story really resonated with him. And he was able to work through the story and say, "Yeah, look, you know, I've got these bad bricks, but I've also got these good bricks." And he talked about being a grandfather, loving his grandkids, being a friend, having friends, wanting to support his friends. And I guess we kind of felt like Ajahn Brahm's friend in a way, that helped him see the bigger picture with this guy. But there's this process in the hospital, it's called the forensic leave panel. So you can go to this legal panel to apply for leave outside the hospital. And who sits on the panel is either Supreme or County or District Court, Supreme or District Court judge, a psychiatrist and a community member. So he went to present his case, you know, for day leave outside the hospital, and he took his, he had a worksheet from the group that we ran, and he took his worksheet in and talked about. He said, "In the hospital, everyone just sees my bad bricks. They see, you know, see my offence. They see the bad stuff I've done here. They see my mental illness, but I've got all these good bricks too." And he talked about his role as a grandfather and his role as a friend, and, you know, how he offered support to his friends and how he cared for his grandkids. And I was kind of proud of that outcome, you know, of him taking the message in the group that far. But But it's, you know, I share that story too because it's one that resonates with me, you know, and it makes me think about my, I guess, you know, my tendency to focus on some of my own maybe vulnerabilities or shortcomings, you know, that I may perceive in myself, and how the help of good friendship really broadens my mind, you know, and a particular friend, Shanti, comes to mind. And Shanti, you know, Shanti and I know a lot about each other, and we're kind of, you know, there for each other at times of need, and we talk a lot, and I just get the sense that he knows what I consider my bad bricks anyway. But when I talk with Shanti, and he gives me feedback, and he talks back with me, it's always, he just directs me to my good bricks, you know. He helps me see the bigger picture, and I feel it's done in a real genuine way. So it just makes me think about some of the qualities of, you know, spiritual conversation. It's just that genuine approach and the genuineness that I experience, you know, particularly from Shanti there. But I kind of wanted to, you know, put it to everyone in the offer or invite everyone in the audience tonight, and if you're at home, just to reflect, if you're willing. Now you might. Now you can take a breath, or just, you know, just to feel your body in your seat or in your chair, and just take a moment to think about who a spiritual friend is in your life. Like, who is it that you've experienced that helps you see the good bricks? And then just noticing how that feels. Bringing that person to mind. Just noticing what that's like. And you can, if anyone has got the burning desire to, you can always say the name of the person, maybe out of appreciation or something of that nature, if you'd like to. Anyone here wanted to, offers there to share if you're willing and wanted to. But it's okay. So just, you know, just keep them in mind. If you're able to think of someone, you know, a good spiritual friend there. But the next story, you know, I'll move on to is a story of Anguli Mala. And it was another real success in the forensic hospital. And if you don't know the story of Anguli Mala, you'll understand why it was so context appropriate for the hospital. Because, you know, a lot of the people that we did the group with, I dare say, you know, half or majority had killed, had taken the life of another person. So Anguli Mala's story, you know, landed well in that regard. I think it was relatable. It was kind of a notch above what most people had done in there. But the story of Anguli Mala, anyway, his name Anguli Mala means finger necklace, because he was a serial killer from the Buddha's time, and it was 2,500 years ago. And he was a man that lived in a forest, and he'd taken the life of 999 people. And one day the Buddha ventured into the forest, and knowing, you know, Anguli Mala was in there, and on his way into the forest, people were stopping the Buddha and saying, you know, stop, don't go in there. There's a bandit, there's a killer that lives in there. And, you know, he takes down armies of people, takes down, you know, 20, 30 people at a time that go in looking for him. But the Buddha just stayed quiet and kept going inside, kept walking into the forest. And eventually Anguli Mala spotted the Buddha. And he thought, well, this will be my next kill. This will be my 1,000th kill. So, you know, he jumped out of the bushes, started running after the Buddha. And the Buddha used his psychic powers and just kept walking at a steady pace away from Anguli Mala. Whilst Anguli Mala had his sword, had his shield, he was chasing the Buddha as fast as he could, he couldn't catch up with the Buddha. And the Buddha was just, you know, at walking pace with his psychic powers, a step ahead of Anguli Mala. Until Anguli Mala, you know, sort of burnt out with fatigue, sort of dropped and shouted out to the Buddha, said, stop, monk, And the Buddha, you know, just slowly kept walking and said, "I've already stopped. I've already stopped. Now you stop, Angulimala." And Angulimala responded again and said, I don't know how to make sense of that because I've stopped. I'm here. I'm not moving. But you keep walking, yet you tell me you stopped." And the Buddha's response to Angulimala was, he said, "Angulimala, I've stopped forever." He said, "I've stopped killing and harming. Now you stop killing and harming." And then he turned and he faced Angulimala. And, you know, what I imagine to be a real, to have a real presence in that encounter and real loving kindness in that encounter. And it was there that that Angulimala threw his sword away, threw his shield away, and asked to robe up and become a monk. Asked to ordain with the Buddha, and the Buddha took him on as a monk. And he took his precepts and he kind of changed his ways in that point. But it's what I like about that story there, particularly in the theme of spiritual conversation, is, you know, he has this kind of exchange with the Buddha, like saying stop, and the Buddha saying, no, you stop, and I've stopped, and him not making sense of that, and them talking around it. But also being met by that that presence, you know, I imagine that would have had a lot to do with his willingness to transform. So again, I just wanted to offer another reflection to you tonight, and you know, just if you just feel yourself in your seat again, or feel yourself on your cushion, it's just to recall a time that you've been met by the loving presence of someone else, that unconditional presence of another, and just to notice how that feels for you as you bring that to mind. But just to keep moving on with the Angulimala story, you know, the next part of the story is that he's out as a monk now on alms round, and he's walking through one of the villages, and he sees a woman struggling in labour. And in witnessing this woman struggling in labour, he has a real sense of compassion that evokes in him, you know, seeing her difficulty. But he doesn't know what to do with it. He wants to be helpful, doesn't know what to do with it. And he goes back to the Buddha and kind of again engages in spiritual conversation and talks about this experience of seeing this woman suffering and asks what he can do. And the Buddha said to Angulimala, "Well, why don't you go back and offer her a blessing and say to her, you know, by the fact that I'm someone who since birth has not intentionally killed any living being, I offer you and your new child a happy and healthy birth." And Angulimala, in response in his dialogue, says, "But I can't say that. I can't go and say that to this woman because I've killed 999 people." And the Buddha responds again and says, "We'll go to this woman and share with her that since I've taken birth in the noble life as a monk, I've not intentionally killed or harmed any living being." He says, "Okay, well, I can do that one." So he goes and he finds this woman in labour and he chants for her. And as a result, you know, his blessing, you know, supports her in having a good birth, and her and the child are healthy and well. And he feels good, you know. I imagine that, and that type of service, I imagine, brought a lot of, you know, good energy into his mind. But it just speaks to another aspect of spiritual conversation for me, is compassion and that desire to serve, to be helpful, to meet those in need. And I think, you know, like these two stories, I recount them, the Angulimala story and the Two Bad Bricks story, because they resonate with me personally. And you know, that experience of the Angulimala blessing was offered to my partner Magda when she was pregnant with our daughter Yana. So we're living in Melbourne at the time, and we went in to see Ajahn Nisarano down at the Buddha Loka Centre there, and and Arjuna Sara and I offered that blessing for Magda. And we had it, you know, we had a fantastic birth experience, you know, like a healthy and positive birth experience. And I imagine that, you know, that was one of the causes amidst it there. But I guess, you know, to offer another reflection there, just based on that aspect of the story in relation to compassion, I wonder, you know, if you're willing, and you're there in your seat, and you might just take a moment to have a breath or to just relax into your seated position again. And just to think, you know, is there an experience in your life where you saw the difficulty of the human condition? And when that evoked a real sense of compassion, a real sense of, you know, wanting to help, wanting to care or support another being. So just to notice what comes to mind for you there. And to notice how that feels. What does that sense of compassion feel like? And I guess the final part of the Angulimala story that I want to talk about is another part of the story which goes back to his pre-murdering days. And it talks about him as a young man named Ahimsa. And he was a diligent student and practicing a, you know, spiritual path underneath a guru at the time. And he was so diligent and so switched on in his practice that his fellow students were jealous of him. And so a rumor was spread about Ahimsa, that he'd slept with his teacher's wife. And the rumor had got back to the teacher. The teacher, believing this rumor, really wanted revenge, really wanted to lead Ahimsa astray. So he gave him this task. He said, you know, for you, Ahimsa, to go out and kill and take the fingers of 1,000 people to... and show your loyalty and to, you know, adhere to this practice that I teach here, knowing it would lead him astray. And he went out and, you know, we had Angulimala, you know, sort of the man that killed 999 people. But, you know, hearing that context helps me, and it kind of, you know, links me to the idea of, you know, right view or right understanding in our practice in terms of, you know, karma and cause and effect. And you can see, you know, like this was a man, and there was these cause and conditions that happened in his life that led him a certain way to doing, you know, pretty horrendous things. And it was really similar, you know, when I worked with a lot of people at Thomas Embling. A lot of people I saw really good qualities in, and experienced a lot of really good qualities in. But, you know, as a social worker, I, you know, would look at their histories and, you know, read the sort of historic reports, and you just get a sense of the background to what led up to, you know, the event, which, you know, which could have been a murder or another serious violent offence. And you see, you know, like there really wasn't one person there that I knew their history and it didn't make sense of how things had played out in their life. You know, whether it was, you know, trauma or parenting or, you know, stigma and social exclusion, you know, lack of precepts, you know, so drug and alcohol. And you could just see it was kind of like an imperfect storm that came together and resulted in what it did for these people. But I think, you know, personally, like I really love the Angulimala story for that reason too. You know, I've got that relationship to it from the birth of my daughter. But also, you know, just it helps me have confidence in the Dharma to know that a man, Angulimala, who'd killed 999 people in his spiritual friendship with the Buddha, then in his subsequent practice, he was able to progress on the path and become enlightened eventually. You know, and I think back, and there's things that definitely before my precept days that are quite regrettable that I did. to do with drinking alcohol and to do harms that came about from that old activity. And some as a Buddhist that have kind of lingered in my mind, you know, and I've kind of feared the karma of what they might bring. So this story, you know, personally for me, it does bring an ease and a relief, but like I said, a confidence too. And hopefully for you too, you know, in hearing that, it brings a confidence for you in your practice and in your spiritual friendship. And just, you know, I guess, you know, that is on offer here, and the phone lines, you know, one way of maybe experiencing it, some of that spiritual friendship, if you're not in the room tonight and you feel the need for it. People that are trained in that sort of compassionate, present, mindful, attentive listening, you know, they practice loving kindness, so there's a chance to, you know, share and be heard in your probably very human experience. So I think, you know, I'll leave the talk there for now, and we can move into the meditation for this evening. So just to find whatever postures is most comfortable for you. Let's take a moment to feel into your body and find that posture. And I wonder if there was someone in the talk when we're talking about spiritual friendship that did come to mind for you. If there was a spiritual friend that you were able to bring to mind, think of their presence, and just to notice the feelings that might evoke for you. Possibly feelings of loving kindness, or feelings of being supported. And just take that feeling evoked down to your feet. And just that relaxed, friendly attention just up into your calves, over your shins. Just feeling into your knees. Just into your thighs. Just taking that friendly, relax the tension there. Just the weight of your body into your seat. And up into your abdomen. Maybe just noticing the rise and fall of the breath. And just moving up into your chest, upper back area. And just noticing if any of that feeling, that sensation evoked by your spiritual friend is still lingering somewhere in this part of your body. And just carrying that feeling down your shoulders and down your arms. Out into your hands. Just moving up the neck. Friendly, relaxed attention. It's into your face. So just relaxing the jaw and the cheeks. The eyes. The brow, and all the way up over the back of the head to the top of the head. And just sort of bringing that friendliness, that loving attention all over your body. And just inviting you to just to practice, let your meditation continue. Just continue in silence now until the remainder of the time we have. We're all ring the gong at the end. So just coming towards the end of the meditation. So there's a little bit of time left if anyone wants to ask me anything, or if anyone wants to share some of your own experience, maybe around the themes of the stories tonight. Well, come and join us. You can come and share up here. No, you can share from there if you like. There's often a microphone that...
Just check it. Doesn't feel like it's on. But
oh, is it on?
Yeah, I can hear. Yeah.
Okay, sure. Thank you so much for your talk. Really appreciate it. And who came to mind for me for spiritual companion was Ajahn Vayama. And I'd just like to send a big thank you. I haven't got words, really, to say what a profound impact she had on my life and continues to have on my life. She's, been a very powerful, influential spiritual companion in my world. I don't know if I'll ever come across somebody like that again that I have that connection with. And I just want to say thank you to her.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I've got a question and an announcement rolled all into one.
Yeah, nice.
I'll just sit over here. So from the 3rd to the 5th of December, the care group are going to be holding a retreat. And one of the things we'd like to do at the retreat is explore the concept of reflective listening. And one of the talks I prepared is the difference, looking at the difference between sympathy and empathy, and then moving on from that to look at, how do we move from empathy to compassion? And it really got me thinking about the work that you've been doing, Conrad, because clearly, when we empathize with someone, we put ourselves in their shoes, and it's kind of an entrainment which happens. But compassion's a little different. Now, clearly, talking to some of your patients, is it right to call them patients?
In that context, yeah.
Some of them have done terrible things, no doubt. So it might be hard to feel a degree of empathy. But the penny just dropped for me. That it's more about compassion, isn't it? So how would you... I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah. What's the question?
But it's a really interesting thing. Like, so how do you how do you personally demonstrate compassion when you're seated with these people who have done quite terrible things?
Yeah. Well, I think the two bad bricks is a good story to work with, you know, to know that they're more than the mistake that took them inside that hospital. And often, you know, I met a lot of the people before I knew the histories too. So I got to meet the person and realise it's a decent human here. You realise what's happened in the past. You see, I think being able to see beyond it helps, but to know it's, you know, not to be, what's the word, like a, is it Pollyanna? You know, not to pretend it's all good, to know it's there, but to know that it's not only that.
And how do you maintain your place of stillness and awareness when you're talking with someone who might have done such things? So I always love the way Ajahn Brahm says, you know, when he goes to a prison, he doesn't see a murderer.
Yeah.
He says he sees a person who's committed a murder.
Mm. Yeah. But that was my experience in the work. And I had that teaching of Ajahn Brahm's in mind before going in there. How does it work? Like, how do you do it? Is that the question?
Yeah, how do you do it? How do you maintain your level of self-awareness and your level of calm and stillness?
Yeah.
It's a hard question.
I think it's the same answer that I would have given before. It's just to be willing to see the whole of the person. You know, I've made mistakes, and I know that's not all of me. And to know that, you know, what mistakes they made is not all of them too. And then maybe, you know, a bit of sort of right understanding. It's just knowing that if I was in a similar position to them, you know, the similar causes and conditions that they grew up with, maybe I would have done the same thing as well.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, that's a taste of the role plays we will be doing at the retreat. But thank you so much for coming and sharing your story.
Yeah, no, thank you.
And for the lovely meditation as well.
Yeah.
And Careline's still open. So if you'd like to reach out and talk to someone, the WhatsApp's a pretty good way of doing it. And I just ducked up the care house and they were taking a few calls. So if you can't get through, just send something through on the WhatsApp. And the retreat, yes, please. care@bswa.org. It's down the bottom of the screen. Shoot us an email. I'll send you the registration form. Thank you. Oh, and tea and biscuits and fellowship and friendship and all of those beautiful ships across at the kitchen area. Please come and join us. Thank you.